There's some pictures of it. It just, so on the other side of my building, as I said, over the years, I've had a lot of stuff there. As I said, when I came back to town in 74, I practiced in Watertown 4 years and came back here. And I believe there was a candy store in there where local board 43 had gone out. And then, there were, of course, law office has been over on my side ever since the early 50s. And the candy store went out, and my neighbor, a friend, Russ Bland, opened up a sporting goods store. And he was in the sporting goods store for quite a while, sold it to another fellow who ran the sporting goods store, and then sold it to another fellow who... And then a little gift shop went in after that other fellow. But every one of them, after Russ, and the only reason Russ didn't have a problem is he did taxes on the side and he did accounting, is that their biggest problem that they had is they couldn't make any money. And I had a hairdresser in here. They all had problems. Put baseball in, never had a month that they can make the rent. And so what has happened basically is that, as I see it, from based on what I'm doing, what we're doing is on Main Street, is that the rents, the mortgage prices, the cost of buildings are all in a position where you can't make it unless you have a high volume of in any industry other than the tourism industry is competing with catalogs and discount stores and the Walmarts of the world, and the fact that you can travel to Albany, you can travel to New Jersey, you can go to shopping malls and A, probably get them cheaper or have a bigger selection. And as a result, baseball is about the only thing that can sustain the rents, the taxes, and the cost of owning a building. Whether that's going to hold up for long, I don't know. But I don't see where you can ever get the dry goods back, because people are constantly going to want the services, the policeman 24 hours a day in multiples, the streets up in good shape, the lights, the whole bit, the cost of doing business, the sewers, and I just don't see where that can be handled by selling to a captive group of 2,000 people, and with the vast majority of the 2,000 people wanting to shop out of town anyway. Main Street is a dilemma. I mean, it's hard to own. You don't want a big mortgage. You don't want to have to pay interest if you can avoid it, because it's hard to economically make it. And I mean, Riverwood, Rick Gibbons, he does well because he has a little niche, but still he gives into baseball. Everybody else, I think, you know, the restaurants close because it's cheaper to be shut than it is to be open in the winter. A lot of the baseball stores close because they don't want to have the help in the winter. So that the town has changed, and it has changed as a result. I think partially because of what society is now. I mean, we're more oriented towards the hospital and as an employer, and you don't have the agricultural employees that you had before. You don't have the farming industry where people were looking for blue jeans and sweatshirts. You're now it's a different those that element that's not going to travel to spend isn't there.
You mentioned the Clark family and receiving their scholarship. How did that affect your future and going to Colgate?
It probably didn't affect it much, because it probably would have gone anyway. Well, I was going to go anyway. I had a scholarship there that was almost a full ride. I was an only child, so I was very fortunate. But a lot of kids, it's really made a lot of difference. Of course, today, I don't know if it makes a lot of difference. It makes some difference, but when I went to college, room board tuition was probably under $3,000. And I had maybe $3,500 at the most. And I had a state scholarship, I had a Clark scholarship, and I had an honorary scholarship from the college. And I was making money going to school. And I had looked at a number of private schools. I looked at Hamilton and Syracuse, Cornell, Yale, and Colgate. And I ticked Yale off the list real early because it was out of state and I had a state scholarship. I pretty much needed to handle a state scholarship. That was like $1,500 back in those days. And I got ticked off at Syracuse because Syracuse was going to have me known by my social security number. And I said, I don't want to be known by a number. I'd like to be known by name. And Cornell was just awful big. I was familiar with Cornell because I had been down there with agricultural 4-H things. And it was just a little bit bigger than I wanted to deal with. Though I don't know if it's much different than Syracuse. But I'd been to Syracuse, too. So I boiled it down to Hamilton and Colgate, and they were about the same price, and they were about the same deal. So I went to, my father had indicated to me that he hadn't gone to college, but he said if he'd gone to college, that's where he would like to have gone. I went to Boys State there, and I spent week Boys State at Colgate. I liked the whole arrangement. I'd gone to Hamilton for a sub-freshman weekend, I was a little taken back by some of the stuff that was going on. Probably if I'd gone to Colgate and seen the same thing going on, I would have maybe made the other decision, but there was nothing more than whatever goes on everywhere, isn't it? You know, people were all heading out to who knows where for the weekend, and I just wasn't used to that growing up on the farm, growing up here in Cooperstown. You didn't go ramming all over the countryside. You didn't, by the time I got to Colgate, I understood that. So probably wouldn't have made a lot of difference to me, but it would have made a lot of difference to a lot of kids. The Clark, before they did the scholarships, they had what they called punctuality prizes, you had to go 10 weeks in school without missing it, and then you could have an excuse for sickness and miss a day. And at the end of 40 weeks like that, you could go to Auger's and get a book. And they would supply X number of dollars for books that you could buy at Auger's. I did that, I think, all the way through until they started the scholarships. I never missed many days over the years.
What was Colgate like in the late 60s?
Oh, well, I was in the early 60s.
Early 60s.
I got out in 67. Mid-60s. I got out in 67. And it was small. There were 300 and... There was under 400, 350, 60 people in my class. You knew everybody. There was 1,300 total at school. You you knew the names of everybody, and if you didn't know them, you'd recognize them. You knew all the professors. There was no grad students taught courses. They were all taught by professors. There were a good, strong faculty. Faculty very receptive to the students, and they're always available for you. We partied hard. When we partied hard. It was essentially a Division I school, sports-wise, even though we were very on the small end. Had a very good hockey program, big student support there, excellent theater program. I was business manager of the theater for 3.5 years. They were under a lot of construction. They built a new theater while I was there. They rehabbed several buildings. You traveled a lot. It was a men's school, so you were always off one place or another on weekends, and they had like winter, and spring party weekends. And those are the times that the girls would come to Colgate. The rest of the time, you really traveled. Syracuse, Cornell, whatever. It was pretty academically oriented. We did a lot of... the programs were... I was a history major, and it was a pretty rugged program. We wrote a lot of papers. My senior year, I was in London, first half a year. We took a program over to London with the first year. It was a dozen history majors with a professor. And we had our classes at the Central YMCA on Tottenham Court Road. We had a room there that we did our classes in, and the professor we took was a gentleman from Georgia, Bill Askew. He was a good... He and I butted heads all the time, but we really liked each other. He had tremendous contacts. He was respected in the academia area, and he was able to get all sorts of historian writers, A.J.P. Taylor, Charles Bowatt, they all came and lectured to us. It was just phenomenal. You read these people's books, teach them as a treatise, and then you get them in, and they actually came and spoke to us. And he had enough context that we got into Whitehall, and we got into the Department of Agriculture, and we got into 10 Downing Street. I walked through the front door of 10 Downing Street and sat in a chair and had a talk to by their press secretary or whatever. And I sat in a chair like this, and you could smell the scotch in the chair. You learn very quickly how good the professors were because of all the contacts that they had. And we actually were able to get into the reading room of the British Museum and do research in there. And apparently, we were told that you generally didn't get in there unless you had at least a working on a master's degree. He got us in, and we all had our cards and could go in. And once you've been assigned a card, I guess you have it for life. I've never tested it. I've been back in the reading room in 2001, but they've moved the vast majority of the British Library reading room. The programs were good. It was a good school. It grew tremendously after I was out. I think it's 2,800 now, under around 3,000, went co-ed. I guess they got more graduate programs than they had. They had one graduate program when I was there. That was the reason it could be a university. They had a program in education. Good school. I still go up for sporting events, and I get on their line for all their lectures. Clinton spoke there just this fall on family weekend. There was a couple other lectures I would have liked to have gone up for, but there's such a hassle today to go to. They had one there that I really wanted to go to, and I had tickets to it, as a matter of fact. I think maybe, I don't know, it was Colin Powell, perhaps. And I had tickets to it, and I didn't go because you had to be there 2 hours early, and you had to sit for an hour and after you got cleared through security, et cetera, et cetera. And I just didn't... it was a little more than I wanted to deal with.
Did Colgate influence your decision to pursue a law career?
Yeah, a little bit. I decided I wanted to go to law school a long time before that, when I was home. And I went to Colgate and went through the standard drill that people go through. I decided I wanted to be an archaeologist, and then I decided I wanted to be a college teacher, and finally I decided I wanted to go back to law school again. Why don't you shut that off just a second? Somebody.
No.
So, yeah, I wanted to go to law school for probably the oddest reason anybody ever had for law school. Is that I liked to hunt. And I really loved the farm. But my father never could hunt early in the morning or late in the afternoon because he was always had chores. And I'd look out. And the only guys I'd see out hunting and riding around looking hunting was the fellow that drove the oil truck and the local lawyer. And I decided that I really didn't want to drive an oil truck. I said, so I guess probably ought to go to law school. And I knew the lawyer at Hartwick. He was a friend of my parents. And he encouraged me. And he wanted me to go to Syracuse, and I did. Well, that was basically... Stranger reason as it is, but that was the reason I got interested in it, and that was the reason I probably pursued it.
What type of experience did you have in law school?
Oh, good. I didn't like law students. I had a roommate. It was for 2 years. It was in law school, and we shared an apartment. It was a good guy. But we would go over and do our thing and then go back to our apartment and spend the rest of the day being human. The law students had a tendency to be too focused on trying to on the law and not on the human experience. And I always thought there was more to it than that. And I understood it. I got it. It clicked. I understood the teachings of the law real quickly. It was something I liked it, and I enjoyed it, and academically it was good. I understood what was wanted, what was desired, and I liked doing it, and I was the 10th in my law school class. I was right there. I knew what was going on, and understood it. I did far better there academically than I had done undergrad. Undergrad, I had about a 3.2 average. And I got to law school, law school was completely different grading. I ended up in 10th.
Out of how many students?
108.
How did you pick your specialty?
Well, I knew I was going to do a general practice. And I had worked one summer for attorneys here in town, and they did basically what I'm doing now, and I really liked it. It's, you know, real estate and estates and stuff. I tried cases when I was in Watertown. I was one of the trial men. Senior partner died 20 days after I got there. So I was thrown in the breach. They just handed me a bunch of files and said, go try them. And so I learned under fire and did reasonably well, but I just didn't care for it as much as some other things. I like dealing with people, and I like the puzzles that real estate provide.
What drew you back to Cooperstown after you finished, after being in Watertown?
I always planned to come back. It was family, neighborhood, area. It was just a... I had taken a compass and drew a circle 35 miles around Cooperstown and said any job outside that 35-mile area I'd consider, because I wanted to learn elsewhere. And I did. And I came back when I had a chance to come back here. And I had always intended to come back. I just didn't know how or when. My parents were here. Judy and I were coming back here about every third week anyway, for the weekend. And I had picked this lot out to build on when I was a kid. So I came back and built our house here.
How did you meet your wife?
Blind date. It's about the only good thing my cousin ever has done in his lifetime. I had a car, and he was at Syracuse. I had a car, and he knew the girl. So it turns out that my wife was good friends of what turned out to be my best friend from high school's wife. And we had a common acquaintance, so to speak. So we were able. So we got together. Got married after I'd been out of law school for a year. She was undergrad music at the time. And she taught for a year, and I practiced for a year, and we got married.
What is the most challenging part of practicing law in your hometown, where you know everyone?
I think that's it. You know everybody. Occasionally, you have to pick sides on things that might not necessarily be what you ever thought it was going to be. Probably the most challenging part is not have your feelings hurt when somebody goes to somebody other than you, and someone that you know and you thought were good friends. But after you've been around a while, you know a lot of people and you have a lot of friends, and so it doesn't mean that much. You learn to accept when people are going to go one place or another. And you got to be willing to take on the system occasionally, even though it might not be the popular thing to do.
How did you feel when your son decided to become a lawyer?
I was happy. I was a little surprised. He had indicated to me at one point in time that he wanted to go to law school, and I said, I mean, I haven't convinced you not to, and he said, no. But he pretty much did it on his own, and he decided he wanted to go to law school, and that was good. And when he went, I said to him, I said, they're going to tell you that, you know, I said to him, there's always a place for you to work here, and and he wanted to go to New York City. And there weren't jobs available in New York City for his skills. And he decided that his fiance, wife, whatever now, liked the area. So he's decided maybe he would hang around, and he's done real well. And he's fitting right in now. He has some, he's an assistant district attorney on a part-time basis and represents some towns, and he likes the fact that he knows a lot of people.
And both of your daughters, two daughters, moved away from town?
Yeah, yeah. My oldest daughter worked for Will Mooney in the antiquarian book from the time she was like 12 on. And when she was a junior, between her junior and senior year, she decided she was going to get a job with PIRG. And so she was going to get it in California. And she got out there and called me up, and I can remember the call. She says, "Dad, I got to beg for money out here. That's what they want me to do, and I don't beg well." And I says, "Well, see what you can do, and then we'll figure it out." Well, she was smart enough when she left that she had a letter of recommendation from Will Mooney. And so she walked into the one of the best antiquarian bookstores in on the West Coast. The guy was head of the ABA and all those things, and they knew Will. And he said, "Well," he says, "I really don't have anything available, but if by the end of the day you don't have anything, come back and see me." So she came back and see him the end of the day, and he hired her. And so she worked for him for the summer and did a catalog on, I think she did a catalog on some Polish author, poet or something, and he was very pleased with what she had done, and offered her a job for the next year. And she came back, went to school, and decided that she wanted to go to New York, and nothing opened up in New York. So I said, "Well," my wife said to her, "Well, why don't you look at the job you had offered out there?" Well, he said he'd made a job, he'd make a job for her. So she went out, and she went out there and worked for him for time enough to pay off her loans, because he was very generous and he gave her a pretty good salary. And then she got worried about being caught in the antiquarian book business, because she decided she didn't want to be in that business. So she ended up quitting and did temp work for a while, and then did some subbing, and then went back and got her teaching certificate, and then went and got her master's and decided she really loved teaching. And while she was out there, I think she had some trouble with the boyfriend or something. And my other daughter, who graduated from Wesleyan, decided that she really didn't have any place in particular to go. She and her boyfriend, who's now, they're now married, he was a year behind her at Wesleyan. She'd worked down in Middletown, Connecticut for a theater down there. She was that was sort of an interim job. She said, "Well, I can get a job anywhere. It's in the theater," because she was pretty well known that. And so I said, "We'll go out there." I says, "We'll go out and see what the story is." So she went out to Berkeley, and she worked as a carpenter, and she worked as various theater groups. Went to where she is now, and it was showed up at 10 o'clock in the morning when they asked her to be there with her tools, and the guy says it. That night he says, "You know, I'm going to hire you more often, because," he says, "you showed up on time, came with your tools, better tools than we had, and you didn't leave till the job was done." So then eventually she got a full-time job with him. And so again, it's sort of happenstance. Her husband is works for GameSpot in San Francisco, which is a online reviewer of games, video games. And whether, you know, how long he'll stay in that business and how long they'll stay on the West Coast, I don't know. I think my older daughter probably is there for a while, but as long as she teaches. But she still wants to keep the farm going, and she likes to come home for that.
Do you wish they would move back?
Yeah, maybe. But I don't know. The weather isn't conducive for her to be back here. It's nicer weather out there.
And so you're going to become a grandfather for the second time?
And third time.
Third time.
Yeah. She's about to have a baby.
What lessons do you hope to teach your grandkids?
Well, I'd teach them about the land. Teach about the land. Teach them to respect the land. You know, we use it. We're just part-timers. We don't own it. We use it. I'd like to have them learn about the farm, the land, how to be reasonably self-sufficient. I bring my little grandson out in the garden with us now. We pull carrots and pick beans and do those things.
What legacy do you hope to leave in Cooperstown?
I don't know as I've ever really worried about leaving a legacy. I hope that I'm remembered for being honest and loyal. And I have a feeling loyalty is one of the things I feel very strong about. Make sure that when I know somebody and they, if I tell them I'm going to do something, I'll do it. Even if it inconveniences me, I'll do it. That's why I get booked up triple time sometimes, but I do it.
Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Glad to talk with you. Stop.